Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to be permanently sick? While our culture might seem obsessed with health and wellness, the reality is that one out of every three Americans lives with chronic illness of some kind. And because of advances in medical technology, even diseases that were once nearly always fatal, like HIV and many cancers, can sometimes be kept under control for years or even decades. Still, a diagnosis of a potentially life-threatening condition is no small thing, especially when it comes out of the blue. To deal successfully with chronic illness, we need to seek treatment, set priorities, and face limitations without allowing our diagnosis to define who we are as people. Dr. Julian Seifter is a nephrologist and associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. He is also chair of the Committee on Protecting Patients and Human Research at Brigham and Women's Hospital, author of the new book After the Diagnosis, Transcending Chronic Illness, and for the past 30 years or so, he has himself been living with a chronic illness, type 1 diabetes. Julian, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Aside from the obvious physical discomforts and inconveniences and limitations, why is it so hard to be sick in America?
I think that it's hard to be sick for many reasons. For one very good reason, it doesn't feel well. Many people are given a diagnosis at a time when they feel ill, and dealing with that is hard enough. But there's also the prospect of chronicity. I think that it's difficult for many people, and we're talking about 90 million Americans have some form of chronic illness. The idea of having something that's never going to go away, and I think that, you know, for example, if you have something that is of an acute nature, if you have a pneumonia or something that can be treated with antibiotics and then go away, there's this feeling that you take your medication and you'll be better and you can go on with your life. I think one of the very difficult things that patients and I certainly faced was the idea that life is different now, that I'm going to have to really change the things that I do. I don't want to let go of things that I do. I have a life. How am I going to manage both an illness and my life?
Yeah, because it's not part of anybody's long-term plan before that diagnosis comes.
And exactly. One can go very suddenly from feeling, as I did, feeling at the top of my game, feeling quite healthy, can do anything, go anywhere, not worry about taking medications, not worrying about controlling a disease, and not having a disease identity, to all of a sudden feeling that that's threatened, and how much am I going to be limited in what I want to do?
And there's got to be the sense, too, that it's just not fair.
It certainly can. People have different personalities and will greet this with different ways. People can meet that with tremendous anger, and others might be quite depressed. Others might actually completely say it's not true, it's not me, this can't be happening. But it's a shock to the system, no matter how you slice it, when somebody first finds out about a diagnosis that's going to stay. It's a shock.
You were 28 when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and one thing that is fascinating about your story and that makes me really appreciate your candor is that you tell us flat out here that for the longest time, you were not the ideal patient.
That's true, and I think that, I see this in many people, and I'm much more tolerant of understanding why it's difficult to be the ideal patient. More and more so now in our society and in our medical establishment, it's this is broken, let's fix it. This is what we can control, let's do it. And there are must-dos, and there's the Ten Commandments of taking care of yourself. And I think that what I think everybody has another life, has other lives, many, many other lives that go on simultaneously with the illness. I was 28, and I was in the middle of my training as a doctor. And specifically in that situation, training as a doctor really was, there was a boundary. We were the healthy ones and the patients were the sick ones. And I really crossed that boundary into playing both roles. And I think for the longest time, because I had such ambitions and because I wanted to do so many things, I really did I did play down my disease for a couple years. I even acted as if I didn't have an illness at all. I still felt pretty well. And I think over the years, I realized that I had made mistakes and that I was trying to do better. And I think that I learned over the years that you can do better and still have a life, that illness can, instead of being an end of possibilities, can be a transformative process that that opens up new areas for growth.
The patient, of course, isn't the only one whose life changes. We have partners, we have friends, we have coworkers. Suddenly, all those relationships take on a new dimension.
That's exactly true. And I think that one of the things that I did in my own situation, which was hard for me, was that I kept it a secret. I was almost I felt that having an illness was a stigma, that I wanted to be the healthy one. I didn't want to be somebody who was ill. I didn't want to be needy. I didn't want to rely on anybody. And I found great comfort in my long marriage. My wife Betsy, who is a co-writer after the diagnosis, was with me every step of the way. She went through the difficult times. There were times that I wanted to depend on her to help me take care of it. There were times where certainly there can be periods where you're on the same page or you're not on the same page. But I think that sharing the illness with somebody was very important to me, because there's just so much feeling involved that it really is very good if you have somebody that you can talk to.
And you write that it's important, at least when it's possible, to keep the relationship pretty normal. It's still okay to fight with someone who has a chronic illness. It's still okay to disagree about things. It's okay to lean on the partner who is sick occasionally for emotional support.
Exactly. And sometimes the partner may actually take charge and be very, very strict. And I see this in couples all the time in my office. There may be a spouse, for example, as a partner, who would really manage things in the house. There are other types of situations where there's actually conflict, where the household shouldn't change because of one person in the house who's ill. So it can go all in one way, all in another way, or there can be a good balance. And I think everybody's different, and I've seen very successful arrangements that grow over years. And the relationship may change. It may be one way at first, and then people can adapt together. But there's a lot for the significant other to adapt to.
Julian, when you talk about having witnessed different kinds of relationships and how partners respond to each other when a chronic illness comes up, it occurs to me that you know your patients very well. A lot of us in this country, if we see doctors, it's for 5 or 10 minutes, maybe once a year, maybe every couple of years, maybe every few months. What does it take to build a relationship where your doctor knows you even as well as knowing how your partner responds?
Well, I would self-identify as a renegade in that regard. I think that I'm not in favor of the brief appointments, because there's so much that needs to be done. From the point of view of a patient, when a patient comes to see a doctor, the illness is just one very small part of that person's life, usually. I mean, sometimes somebody can be very, very attentive to their illness and really wake up and think about their illness all the time, all day long. But many people also have to walk the dog or do some shopping or go to work, have other lives. And it's only this one brief interface, as you say, that could be for 20 minutes every year or every half year. And that's not really enough time to be able to incorporate what the individual needs are for somebody who has illness, and what are the things that you need to do that are better for taking care of the illness. And I think that more and more what we're losing in this system that we have of these brief encounters is that we are losing this relationship, being able to share with the physician back and forth of, you know, what can I do, doctor? This is what I would like to do. Can we make this happen? Or what am I afraid of? Or what do I believe in? give you a very good example is that I never used to ask people about how they cope with their illness. I do this routinely now, and I'm very interested. For example, there's many people who are religious and find spiritual comfort. Even if that doesn't cure a disease, it helps them live well. And I'm very interested in how people do it. So I will spend a good part of that 20 minutes, which, by the way, I never stick to. I'm well known for going overtime. But I want to know how people do it. And I can learn from that, but I also can support that. And it's only opened me up more, having suffered myself with a chronic illness, it's only opened me up more to find out how people do it. I learned from my patients.
Well, and the other thing about that relationship is that it strikes me that you're able to actually understand how compliant your patients are. Instead of saying, go on a diet, lose weight, quit drinking, you talk to them about whether that's actually going to happen and adjust accordingly. Can you talk about, you had a patient that you thought he was drinking too many martinis and that might be an issue with his hypertension.
So there is a relationship between alcohol, particularly a couple martinis, which he was doing every night, and high blood pressure, and potentially reversible blood pressure changes. So there's also connection to salt and high blood pressure, which most people know about. So he said, you know, doc, the martinis really mean very much to me. I really, at the end of the day, I really need my martini. So I said, well, why don't you just cut out the olives? And you know, which was represented some salt. So there's a little bit of playfulness in this, but there's also a serious statement about that, which is that my goal is not to change somebody's life completely, but try to work with them in a way that that actually is successful, where they can have things that they enjoy in their lives and still take better care of themselves.
I have to imagine that also affects how honest your patient feels he or she can be with you. You hear so often about people going to the doctor and saying what they think the doctor wants to hear instead of talking about their real experience.
So I'd rather compromise and try to reach some compromise that's realistic for somebody. I call it in the book, I call it cheating, but it's really legal cheating. You can have one corned beef sandwich a week instead of every day. But in essence, I think the alternative to that is that patients are not going to want to be honest. They're either going to not want to come to the appointment, or they're not going to want to talk about what, you know, what they're doing that could be viewed critically as non-compliant. And the judge, you know, it's, who wants to go to see a doctor who's a hanging judge? You know, it's just not fun. And I think that people are going to avoid that, and they're not going to want to really open up and say what they're doing.
Julian Seifter is my guest. He is a nephrologist, associate professor of medicine at Harvard University, chair of the Committee on Protecting Patients and Human Research at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and author of the book After the Diagnosis, Transcending Chronic Illness, written with Betsy Seifter. You can join our conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is nephrologist Dr. Julian Seifter. His new book is called After the Diagnosis, Transcending Chronic Illness. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. You write here, Julian, about a patient who explained that very often we're not given a lot of time to really comprehend the implications of a life-threatening illness. Suddenly, for many patients after the diagnosis, things change immediately.
That's right. And I've had many patients tell me, and actually there's an example in after the diagnosis, a patient named Cassandra, who I think said it very well, comes into the doctor's office, is given a diagnosis that's a serious diagnosis, and everything else that's said during the hour or 40 minutes or whatever is just empty. There's nothing heard. Only people can go away with that one word, the diagnosis, and that's all they take away with it. And I think that it's very common to talk over somebody's experience. They're not ready to hear it all. I have a tendency to go very slowly to try to make it seem, that we are going to do one thing at a time in a logical fashion. We're going to work together. But certainly it's a lot to comprehend. And remember, somebody who is not medically astute, this is all news to them.
And you are certainly not recommending that people sort of, put off treatment that they need or do what they need to do to keep symptoms at bay. On the other hand, you have learned there can be significant value to a certain kind of denial. Will you talk about that?
Well, I think denial, so there's a chapter that I call not sick or too sick, just sick enough. And I think some people can actually take denial to an extreme where the illness is not managed at all. And I think that's not what I would want. On the other hand, there are some people that can work the illness into their life very, very well. And that's a very, doctors would say that's a perfect patient. And I certainly don't discourage that. But there are many people who are struggling. And I think that those are the ones where I think that you want to make sure that there's hope, there's the ability to do things and grow with their illness and still actually take care of themselves. So I'm always striving to take good care of somebody and to encourage them to take good care of themselves. I really am not against denying to the point of view of bad care, but I am also understanding of people that don't want to think about being ill all the time. I often ask people, when you wake up in the morning, is the first thing you think of is your disease? Do you feel you are your disease, or are you somebody else who has an illness? And that's what I like to encourage in many situations.
What puts people at risk, except other than the sort of immediacy of a particular diagnosis, for feeling like they're diseased? Have you figured out the qualities that make some people able to sort of move beyond it or manage it emotionally and other people who really sort of fold up into that diagnosis?
I think personality really fits into this very well. I'm often interested in how people have dealt with other struggles in their lives. So, for example, if they've had losses, how have they managed? How do they manage difficult situations? And there are some people who have a very regimented lifestyle, and they have always had that. And when they develop a disease, it's one more thing that they can do very well with. There are other people who have really been very carefree and have taken their freedom to extremes, and they may be bungee jumpers or world travelers, and in that situation, I think you want to try to see how they can best take care of themselves while continuing some of these activities and even inventing new possibilities. I remember one patient that I wrote about who, when confronted with a chronic illness, had to be placed on immunosuppressive drugs that would actually suppress their own immune system so they were susceptible to infection. And it was a young man, and he came in with his wife, and he said that he was taking a vacation. he was going to go camping down the Nile. And I said to him, well, you know, every organism known to man is also camping down the Nile, and I think maybe you should think of another solution. So he came back a few days later. He said, I have a new solution. I'm going to be camping on the Amazon. So I, at that point, I said, can I have the telephone number of your travel agent? And I talked to the travel agent, and I said, what else can we arrange? And it turned out he had a nice walking tour of Scotland, which he ended up enjoying. But I think that, again, there's playfulness in this, but there's also a serious, there's a feeling with illness that you're giving something up. And I think that it really, the doctor can help in terms of trying to see the possibilities.
You know, Julian, we talk so much in this country about personal responsibility and about prevention and about certain kinds of care that can stave off long-term illnesses. So then when people are diagnosed, there is sometimes this sense of guilt, like I have failed and it is my fault. How do you help people get past that to the extent that it's not really worth losing sleep over what's already happened?
Mm-hmm. I'm really an advocate of, I'm against remorse and blame and guilt in when it comes to illness. Actually, I think that there's really no room for that. And I don't believe that the medical profession should make people feel responsible for their own illness. I think that there's a chapter in the book called Just My Luck. And I think that really it's not a good starting place for a doctor-patient relationship to base it on you did this to yourself or you're doing this to yourself. I think the idea is to try to help people do better and not lose sight of the fact that humans are people, and they have they have lifelong habits that are very hard to break, and why give everything up if you don't absolutely have to? And I always look for the you absolutely have to.
Dr. Julian Seifter is my guest. The new book is called After the Diagnosis, Transcending Chronic Illness. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, very interesting topic today. I was diagnosed with a terminal illness 28 years ago, and of course now it's become chronic. However, my conundrum is that there are social implications to the illness. I personally feel fine. However, I have a situation where I need health care and I'm on disability. Well, I'm limited financially because I'm on disability. I'm afraid to get off of disability to get a job that may not pay for health care. I have a pre-existing disease, so I am stuck. I'm now 50. This was 28 years ago. I watched many people who had experienced what I was diagnosed with die. So there's been a lot of psychological upheaval with it. And then, the conundrum is that I feel perfectly fine. I seem functional and not too inhibited. But yet, I'm in a situation where it's not socially a popular position to be in. And I am in a healthcare situation where I'm not able to really live a life that I perhaps had hoped for. And so now and that creates a whole other kettle of fish, as it were, regarding depression, et cetera. And so I guess my statement is that I'm sure there are other people like myself that have found themselves outliving something that was once terminal, but yet they are still plagued with it. It has social ramifications, and yet I, as a contributing individual to society, am limited because I'm afraid to give up what health care I have.
Well, Julian, let's see if we can get a response for you. Is there anything you'd offer to Mike?
Yes, Mike, I think that there are a few things that I hear. One is the stigma of having an illness. And, you know, I'm very pleased for you that this was something that you overcame. But the stigma comes out in many ways. And actually, I experienced this myself. I felt that, I was worried that there might be a sign of weakness, but the other is that I would be worried in my job. How could this be held against me, would there be some insecurity associated with that? I think another, and I think that many people hide illness. It's really not uncommon to do that. And I think the other issue that comes up for you is that you really can't hide illness from insurers because if you get in false pretenses, then they could hold that against you, you know. So you really have to be upfront with insurers. It's not a bad idea to actually have somebody open up in the other, you know, at work as well. You know, it's sometimes safe to tell somebody at work that you have an illness. It was something that I struggled with. The insurance, I was turned down for life insurance, and there are certain pre-existing conditions that make it very difficult, even if those conditions are gone. So there's no laws on the books that require insurers to necessarily be what you would call fair. So I think that this is a conundrum. This is really a problem for many people who have had an illness, even if they're better. I see this in my practice a lot because there are some kidney diseases that really are not going to progress to the point of needing a kidney transplant or kidney failure. And I've written many, many, many letters to insurers to try to be convincing, but sometimes that just doesn't work. And I think that I don't really know the solution to that one. I do think, though, that that the embarrassment that comes with illness in terms of wanting to share with workers, being afraid that you'll lose a job or you won't, you know, I had one patient who worked on construction. And he was very, very worried that if he told the his employers that he would not get the next job. So I think that there are a lot of issues, and I think opening up with your healthcare provider, talking to them about this, you may find some good solutions.
We have an email here from Eric in Bedford who writes, recently I've received a diagnosis for celiac disease. This has necessitated some real-life changes because of the incredibly restrictive nature of a gluten-free diet. My wife and I now have to carefully consider which restaurants we go to, and it's caused us to often opt out of social activities because we know others aren't willing to change meal plans to visit restaurants where I can eat. We've both found ourselves isolated from our normal social circles because of the extra life complications. Is this something you hear often from patients?
Yes, and that's a particularly difficult situation because you'll immediately perhaps feel the consequences of eating the going off the diet.
Yeah.
Because it will cause intestinal problems. So that's very difficult, and those particular diets are very hard. And I think again, there are good nutritionists that are available and good counsel that you can get, and I think that you should seek that to try to see, you know, what kinds of restaurants, what kinds of foods. And I think it's something that a healthcare provider should really get into the very details of this. For example, should know what restaurants or what foods to think creatively might be something that suits somebody's diet. I think instead of just giving a list of do's and don'ts, maybe somebody can think with you to think of ways out of that. I don't know of particular restaurants that would be compatible with that, but certainly there are foods that might be enjoyable that you could seek.
I love this idea, and you do write about it in the book, of focusing on what you can do instead of making every consultation with a doctor about the things that you ought not to do.
That's right. I think illness in general can be in itself very constrictive. And I think that by nature, I guess if I have a belief system, it's optimism. I believe that that there are possibilities and that there are ways to problem solve. And so I'm very open to new ideas. I love the way that my patients do it and teach me how they do it. You know, for example, in this last email, if somebody did figure out how a good idea with respect to celiac disease, that's something that I would love to hear because the next patient that I see, I could share that. And I think this is how good ideas spread. So I'd like to be open. I like to listen to patients as opposed to just pontificate.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Susan in Carrollton. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we sure can.
I was diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome 2 years ago after I was hospitalized with a blood clot in that area. And an angioplasty to repair it injured my ulna nerve. Mm-hmm. So I was left with a hand that was in a claw.
Mm-hmm.
When I came out of the surgery, I was in extreme pain. And I told the recovery nurse, and she informed me that patients didn't have pain after angioplasty. And after that, when the doctor finally came, he said, "Oh, well, we must have injured the nerve, give her something for the pain." After that, I was only treated, you know, they wanted to treat the pain, and I was never offered any solution, and I went from doctor to doctor asking, what's happened to me? How can I be fixed? So I guess I'm asking, number one, how does a patient, you know, pick the doctor? You know, you expect mm-hmm. the doctor to fix what they broke.
Right.
And I guess my second question would be, now I'm on Medicare, who wants to change all of the pain medications that I've been on. Can you offer advice on either of those?
Well, let's first talk about doctors that I think it's important to have trust in the relationship. And what trust means is that I believe you. There is a segment in the book where I talk about my role as a doctor. I'm not trained as a judge. When somebody tells me they have pain, I believe that they have pain. Pain is one of those symptoms that it's possible that somebody might doubt that you have pain. But the problem is that somebody can feel pain. And in my view, I'm not going to be the one that's going to say you don't have pain.
Let me have you pause there because we need to take a quick break. My guest this hour is Dr. Julian Seifter. He is a nephrologist and associate professor of medicine at Harvard. His new book is called After the Diagnosis, Transcending Chronic Illness. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Julian Seifter. His new book, written with Betsy Seifter, is called After the Diagnosis, Transcending Chronic Illness. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, you had started to answer Susan's question, and it sounds like you're saying that we at least need to find a doctor who believes that we are experiencing pain.
I think that whether it's pain, there are other symptoms that the patient may feel that the doctor might not be able to see. So, the idea that seeing is believing, I think, has to have its exceptions. People can sense pain or sense swelling. I see a lot of that, where people feel swollen, and there can be conflict between patient and doctor over whether or not the patient has the symptom. And in general, my feeling is that I believe my patients when they tell me they hurt. I believe them, and I would like to work through that problem. I'm not involved in pain management, but that is a very difficult area, and I think that problem that Susan raises comes up quite a bit, and the tendency to go from doctor to doctor is not uncommon.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with David in Aubrey. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for the call.
Sure.
First off, I wished all the doctors had the approach to medicine your guest does. But I'm having trouble with one of your opening statements, which was that 1 out of 3 people in the United States suffer from chronic illness. Perhaps I have a poor definition of chronic illness, but I'd like to have that clarified. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for your call.
Well, chronic illness could be something like hypertension, which is prevalent in our society, many times undiagnosed. But also we have there are 25 million diabetic patients in the country, and that number is growing. And so that there are many many chronic illnesses, not necessarily all severe, but cancer, as you know, is now in many cases a chronic illness because there are good treatments, as well as HIV, AIDS, and so on. There are many illnesses. It's growing with new diagnostic techniques. We are recognizing more patients who have chronic illness, and just with aging, you're going to see that. So that as we have more elderly in our, as people grow older, have longer life expectancy, that's very good. But cardiovascular disease is very, very common. So chronic illness is, if one is not affected by it, there's a very strong likelihood that you know somebody immediately in your immediate family or among your friends that does have a chronic illness.
We have another email here, and the writer says, I'm a 19-year-old sophomore in college and within the last month was diagnosed with HIV. When I received the results, the first thing the doctor told me was I should not tell many people and choose who I told very carefully. Though I have told many of my friends and family about my situation, I'm torn as to whether or not I should keep my disease a secret or be open and honest with my peers.
So that's a difficult situation because there may be, depending where and in what circumstances, there may be stigma attached. There may be prejudice attached to having an illness. And I think that, I wouldn't say that everybody has to share everything. I think that it really would depend on the individual circumstances. And I think that it's good to share it with somebody who's in your confidence. But there may be things that are of a personal nature that you don't want to share broadly. So I don't believe that that is not something that I would, with broad strokes, say everybody has to do. On the other hand, there may also be some comfort associated with sharing that you have something, particularly if it's an environment that is understanding and not hostile to you. And I think that unfortunately, we don't live in a society where there isn't some hostility towards people that have chronic illness or, in particular, a disease such as AIDS. And this is very unfortunate, but this really would depend, I think, on an individual basis, what you feel comfortable with. I think it's most important what you feel comfortable with, that nobody should demand that you reveal anything. It should be based on what your feeling is and your sensibilities. But it's something to talk to your doctor about. I think a doctor that should be able to advise you, help you in that regard. But in many cases, there's some relief also in being able to talk about it. I found relief. For example, I teach medical students, and for years and years, I would get up in front of 180 medical students, and no one there knew that I had diabetes. And yet, inside, I was worrying that I might pass out from low blood sugars. And one day, after many, many years, I actually told the class that I had diabetes. And what I found was that there was an outpouring of concern for me, and people would say, "Are you okay?" And just sharing it actually gave me a tremendous amount of relief. But again, I think that this depends on the illness. It depends on the environment, and individual choice is very important.
Do you have any particular generalized feeling about Do you have any generalized feeling about the value of support groups for people who are coping with a chronic illness?
Yes, I think support groups can be very, very good. There are obviously things that can go wrong. You can get depressed going into a group, perhaps where you don't feel that you're as sick as they are, or maybe you feel that you're more sick than they are. So there could be some comparison that goes into that. But I think that many support groups, and certainly I have taken part in many, where people learn from each other. I think if you have 10 people in a room as opposed to a doctor and a patient alone, the chances, if it works well, of having people learn from each other, it's just incredibly amplified in terms of how much experience you can learn about, how many tricks of the trade you can learn about, how do people manage, what do people do in this situation or that. So I think that there's a lot, if you have a good support group, that can be very, very successful.
You write, when an illness takes away all your old certainties, you're almost forced into a new awareness. Can you talk about what that awareness might reveal to us?
Well, it depends. There are as we see in some of our callers, there are some illnesses that you can feel quite well. And there are others that it's very hard to forget about. It's very, you know, there's some illnesses that if you don't feel poorly, you can forget about it. And that's easier at some point to forget about it than if you have the chronic pain. And there's what I often ask my patients, for example, there's a section in about a patient who had a disease known as myeloma, multiple myeloma, that affects the bone and caused pain. Well, really, the pain was there most of the day. I ask the patient, is there some part of your day that you get pleasure? Where is it that you get pleasure? And the patient described, well, there's an easy chair that I have in front of the window that every day I go there, I sit there, and I really get into a comfortable position, and I'm able to forget other things. And I think that what I would say is that everybody needs their easy chair. Anybody with chronic illness needs to find where it is that they can, where they can actually close off and in some way escape.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We'll speak with Andrea in Plano. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I have a couple things to comment on. First of all, you know, I find that people who have a chronic illness that is difficult to diagnose, celiac disease, I would say, you know, in the last 10 years there's a lot of awareness, but previously it was very difficult to diagnose, and I find it fascinating that often women are dismissed as it being in one's head versus, you know, really being taken seriously. And I'd like to also comment that, you know, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there. It may not be proven science yet, but these communities, online communities, and those are the support groups, and this is, you know, the person who has recently been diagnosed with HIV, there's opportunity there to feel like you can open up to a group of people where they know what you're going through, and also helpful in finding solutions for the variety of difficulties that come along with that illness. And finally, I just wanted to say that, you know, patients need to feel empowered to be able to end a relationship with a physician if it's not working out. And my comment on that is that, you know, I had a physician who, after a surgery, really dismissed that I was having severe pain. And when I went in after, I sat down with him and I, you know, said, this is not working out for me. You know, I need to know that I'm to be listened to, and I don't appreciate being dismissed that way. So if this is, you know, the way that you're going to handle my care, then maybe we need to part ways.
What do you think about that, Julian?
Well, I think that that's absolutely a good thing to do. I think that you would like to work something out with a physician, but I think that it's okay to bring this up to say, you know, I really have these concerns, you know, if they're not being met, I think it is reasonable to change physicians. And I think that, again, trust in the relationship is key. There has to be, I have to feel I believe what my patients are telling me, and I do that. I don't judge them, and I don't subscribe to the idea of saying to somebody you don't have this symptom. I think that's really over. What's the expression? Out of my pay grade, to be able to tell somebody they don't have a symptom, and I do write about that in the book. I also write about that, you know, some of the issues that women. There are certain illnesses that women are dismissed where it's more common in women, some of the chronic fatigue syndromes and so on, where really people can feel as if they're being accused of malingering. And you know, there are some rare cases where that happens, where people are manipulating doctors, but I don't think that that's a place to start a relationship, and I don't go in with that idea. And I think that if you're not getting what you need from a physician in terms of support and understanding of your symptoms, and really what we would call empathy, and trying to help and trying to problem solve, then I think that getting another opinion is a good idea.
You remind us in the book that no matter what might be wrong with our bodies, we're alive until we die. Can you talk about how that recognition changes the way we live in the present?
I strongly believe that you're alive until you die. And what I've noticed with chronic illness is, even when there are physical limitations that come on, where you know, somebody no longer can walk. In one case in the book, there's somebody who can no longer breathe on his own, has a amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, that there were new possibilities in terms of technology that helped that person go on a ventilator, lived for 10 years and enjoyed family coming in to see him, saw grandchildren, so that there's always possibilities. You're not dead when you're alive. And I think that there's always something that that somebody can do, enjoy, and even when physical illness limits your ability to do the things you used to do. And I think that this is one of the shocks of chronic illness, because the idea of, you know, I call this no, I could never do this, mm-hmm. and then, well, maybe I can. So that when you look forward, and you think that you're going to be in a situation where you're not going to be able to do things, you feel you could never do that. But when the time comes, there's an adaptation physiologically that people make, where they can actually start with where they are and still find out new ways of enjoying themselves and in doing things and finding pleasure.
So quality of life isn't necessarily destroyed.
There's always a possibility for quality of life.
Dr. Julian Seifter is a nephrologist and associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. He is chair of the Committee on Protecting Patients in Human Research at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he is author of the new book, along with Betsy Seifter, After the Diagnosis, Transcending Chronic Illness. Julian, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.